The last thing that I wanted to touch upon in the sugya that we were doing this past Sunday night was the question of the Shliach Tzibur Richa Modim. This was the position, we don't accept this position, this was the position of Rav Huna, that if you're davening and you're behind the Tzibur and you have to decide whether to start your Amita, so Rav Huna said that the criteria you use is, can you reach the end of your Amida before the Chazan gets to Modim? And as the Gemara explained, because Rav Huna believes, even though we don't, that you can say Kedusha in your own Amida when you're davening with the Tzibur, even though you're not saying it with them. So the question is, what exactly is the significance of Modim? And here, Tosos has something interesting to say. The top Tosos writes, Adshe Agia Shliach Tzibur L'Modim. The time, the reason is, Lefisha Tzarach Lashuach Im HaTzibur Shelo Yeroeh Kikofer V'Misha HaTzibur Mishtachan Im Lov. You must bow at Modim. You must bow at Modim, because otherwise it looks like you are not subscribing, you don't believe in the God that the rest of the Tzibur is bowing to, right? Imagine the king walks in and everybody in the room bows except for this one person. So what does that say about that person and how they relate to the authority of that king? And the suggestion would be that person doesn't accept the authority of the king. So therefore, Rav Huna considers it crucial that you be in a position that you can bow at Modim. V'hu'a dinami, Tosa says, you don't have to actually be able to finish your Amida before the Shliach Tzibur gets to Modim. It would be good enough if you can reach Modim at the same time that the Shliach Tzibur is reaching Modim. So then, the Shaper Dami, Kevan Shehu Mishtachave Im Chavirav, he's bowing with everyone else. Aval Ein Gemara Psika Le Ki Haygafna. This is a very difficult phrase to translate, but I think what he means by this is that the Gemara didn't give this criteria because it's very, very, very hard to gauge. It's one thing to say, I know how much time I need for my Amida. Right? Most of us, some of us, I speak for myself, I have a pretty good idea how much time I need for my Amida. But if you ask me within my, let's say, 4.5 minutes that I might typically need, when do I get to Modim? That's a trickier business, right? I don't know exactly. I could guesstimate. You know, I've learned, I want to express my appreciation for the shiur. I think I did last week also for allowing me to give shiur at night, because we had an astounding experience hiking to the top of Long Mountain in the dark and then davening Vasikin. So I davened for the Amud, because I chose to do that because I have a pretty good sense, a little bit of the yekka in me, how long things take. And therefore I think I was within a minute of actual Hanei Tzachama when we started the Amida. That's, I think, qualifies. But I have a sense of how long Sukkot Zimmer takes, how long B'chus Priyashma takes. I don't have a sense of how long it takes within my private Shmon Esrei when I get to the Bracha of Modim. So I think that's all Tosfos means here. The Gemara doesn't give that as a criteria because it's very hard to pin that down. Aval in Nira, what Tosfos says is, the reason for Modim is not the Mishum Modim D'Rabbana Nachavachi, Shemitzvah Lano Zeh Lo Matzina Lo Ikar B'Gemara. Tosfos says it's not the reason why we insist that you be finished your Amida before the Chazan gets to Modim. It's not that you can answer Modim D'Rabbanan. Tosfos says, and this is actually a very difficult line, he says, because you don't find a source for this, a root for this, Modim D'Rabbanan the Gemara, which is very difficult because the Gemara in Sota actually does talk about Modim D'Rabbanan. It talks about, I believe it's called Modim D'Rabbanan, because various Amoraic sages used to say different things when the Shliach Tzibur was saying Modim. Our Modim D'Rabbanan is actually an amalgamation, it seems, of a bunch of different, very, very small prayers that the Moran used to say. I assume that's why it's called Modim D'Rabbanan. So it is a little bit odd that Tosfos doesn't acknowledge that it does exist in the Gemara, but what I think Tosfos means is, yes, there were Amoraim who said these things, and our minhag is to sort of amalgamate various tfilos for our Modim D'Rabbanan, but it's not strictly obligatory. You're not obligated to say Modim D'Rabbanan in the strict sense, and therefore that can't be a reason for using it as a criteria that you have to get up to Modim. You have to be finished with the Amida, with your own Amida, before the Shliach Tzibur reaches Modim. So the reason Tosfos has given us is because you can't not bow when the entire Tzibur is bowing. Now, Tosfos is expressing this idea because it's a setup for the next point. What happens if you miscalculated? Or what happens if you happen to daven in the Tzibur, where their Amida takes 3.5 minutes, and yours takes 7. And sometimes, by the time you're finishing, the chasim is already up to Mogim. So what do you do? Now, the answer can't be, don't start with the Tzibur. That makes no sense, because then you don't have Tzila B'Tzibur at all. The essence, by the way, of Tzila B'Tzibur is starting your Amida when the Tzibur starts their Amida. That's the essence of Tzila B'Tzibur. So it's not really an option to say, well, I'll just wait till, you know, I get to Gal Yisrael. Instead of saying Gal Yisrael with the Tzibur and davening, starting my silent Amida with them, I'll just, you know, wait till the Shliach Tzibur is done and I'll daven. And that's A, a very big burden. B, that would defeat the purpose of having Tzila B'Tzibur. So instead, what do you do when the Shliach Tzibur gets to Modim and you're not finished yet? And you're not at Modim, you're not at Modim either, which was the first point that Tosus made. So Tosus has set this up by explaining that the real problem with Modim is not that you have to say Modim or have to say anything. It's just that you can't be not bowing when the entire community is bowing, because it looks like you don't accept God's authority, or the God who's the authority that Tzibur accepts, you don't accept that God's authority. So therefore, Haraminu Tam, Haya Ragil, Kishahaya Mishpala B'yachad, this is the third narrow line in the Big Tosfos, on Chaf Aleph on the base. Haraminu Tam, Haya Ragil, Kishahaya Mishpala B'yachad. When he would daven alone, Kishahazin Magia L'modim, it means he was stuck behind. When the Chazin would reach Modim, Haya Korea im Hakahol Belo Amiracha. Rabbeinu Tam would bow like the rest of the Tzibur, but he wouldn't say a word. Now here's the one important criteria. The Gemara later in the fifth parak is going to tell us what most of us know, which is that every one of us as an individual, as an ordinary common individual, man or woman, when we daven our Amida, we bow at the beginning of an end of Avos, which is Baruch Atah Hashem Elokei Aseinu, and then Baruch Atah Hashem Again Abraham. And we bow at the beginning and the end of Hodah. We bow at Modim, which is the beginning of the Bracha, and we bow at Baruch Atah Hashem, Hatov Shemuchan Luchan Elah Hodas. That's all we have to bow. A Kohen Gadol, I believe, would bow, I think, at the end of every Bracha, and the Melech would bow the entire time. Once the Melech bowed down, kneeled down, and probably it wasn't kneeling like we do. That would be very hard to do the entire Shemona Esrei, unless you're like a professional major league catcher and it's a very long inning. And even then they tend to get up and sit down in the middle. So it doesn't mean, not really analogous. It probably means bowing when knees are touching the ground. We don't go down obviously that far. So the Melech, once he bows at the beginning, he remains prostrate for the entire Amida, right? That's the special bit in Melech. So the halacha, though, for a private individual is we're not allowed to bow at the beginning of the end or end of a bracha. But if for whatever reason you want to bow in the middle of the bracha, that's okay. So when I start, you know, Baruch Aleinu Hashem Elokeinu Shem, I can't be bowing at the beginning. And when I say Baruch Atah Hashem, the Baruch Hashanim, I can't be bowing then. But for some reason in the middle, I feel as part of my supplication, I want to bow to God, that's permissible. So Rabbeinu Tam would do exactly that. He would make sure to stop in the middle of a bracha. And that's what Tosfos says. The dask of emtsa bracha, abol besof bracha, lo. The amar lekamon, the osro lishros besof kol bracha o bracha. So you're not allowed to bow at the end of brachos. You bow in the middle of the bracha. Okay? Because you're not, none of us are kohanim gadolim. There might be a few kohanim here, but I don't think there's any kohen gadol in this year. So, now you can ask the question. So if Rabbeinu Tam is correct though, if Tosfos, his whole premise is correct, that you're really allowed So the problem with Modim is just that you shouldn't be in an unbound state when the rest of the Tzibur is bowing. So why does the Gemara tell you you have to wait till you reach Modim? Why doesn't the Gemara just say, start your Shemona Esrei, right? If the Shliach Tzibur happens to get the Modim before you are finished, make sure you're in the middle of a bracha. It's not that hard to do. And just bow with them and it won't be a problem. So why not? So Tosfos says, Mihu lachatchila eilasos tein to the mashmahacha. Our Gemara says, clearly, not like Rabbeinu Tam. But again, I don't know that Rabbeinu Tam did this normally if he came in late to shul. I imagine, I could be wrong. It's hard to know what Tosfos means. But Rabbeinu Tam, when he was stuck in that position, let's say he started with the Tzibur, but the Shliach Tzibur went too fast, I'm not sure. But that should not be the position you would have l'chatchila, according to Rav Huna. And again, it's irrelevant to us under ordinary circumstances. I'll tell you where it's actually relevant. It's relevant if you walk into shul and you're late, and then you start your Amida with the Chazan. And you figure, I'll say Ma'amida with him, and then I'll say Kedusha with him, and then I'll continue on my own. The question is, if you continue on your own, will you finish your Amida before he gets to Modim? Right? That's where the situation can come up for us. Right? It's sometimes easier to keep pace with the Shleach Tzibur for the first two brachas, whether you're faster or you're slower, but to do it for the entire Amida can be a little bit hard. So that's where it would come up. So it sounds like L'chatchila, you should not be in a position of doing what Rabbeinu Tam did. Really, you're supposed to finish your Amida. Why not? So Tosa says, it sounds like it's really more proper for you to be doing it really along with the Tzibur and saying Modim or something. Whether it's because of Modim the Rabbanon or really doing exactly what the Tzibur is doing, not just faking it. So Tosus, and I think the explanation is in the next line, even though Tosus is explaining something else. He writes, because of Rashi, the Sukkah, Perif Lula HaGazel, the Adam HaMispalo, the Shama Mepiachaz and Kadesh of Kedusha, Eino Yachol HaHafsit Balanos and Latzibur. That we know, that we see from our Gemara, that if you're in the middle of your Amida, and they're saying Kedusha, or the Chazan saying Kadesh, and you can't say Yehi Shmei Rava, Rashi says you stop, and you remain silent. Why? And v'yamtin ela yishtok, v'yamtin not. You're quiet and you wait a little bit while they do it. The shomea ka'one. That hearing it is as if you said it. Now, so the question is though, both for us for Kedusha and for the Gemara and Rahuna for Modim, what Rashi is correct, that you pause and you rely upon shomea ka'one, so why not do that l'chatchila? Who cares when you walk into shul, where you up in your Amida, how long it's going to take the chasid? It's very simple. Start davening. If the Shliach Tzibur gets the Kedushin and you're not finished, just keep quiet. In fact, that is the halacha. If for some reason you started davening, or your Shemon Esrei is just longer, and the Shliach Tzibur started, when he gets the Kedusha, you stop and you remain silent. That is what you do. But why not do that l'chatchila? Why do Rahuna and Rabbi Shua ben Levi say, no, if you're not going to be finished before either Kedusha, before Modim, you shouldn't start. Why do that? If after all, you can, if Rashi's correct, then you can rely upon Shomea Kona. So Tosa says for Rashi, V'yishlomar doch atchila, im lasos kein, v'aniya chashiva tvei hidr mitzvah. Yes, we believe in Shomea Kona, but it is better for you to do most things yourself than to rely upon someone else's doing. That's the general rule, right? We say, I don't know if this is truly comparable, because I think it's a little bit, maybe it's the same thing. If you know how to daven your own private Amida, you're not allowed to rely upon the Shliach Tzibur. If you don't know how to daven, then that's why they instituted Chazaras HaShatz. But if you know how to daven, so we paskin, you cannot rely upon the tefillah of the Shliach Tzibur. So that, I don't know if that's truly Shomea Ka'ona in certain ways, but in principle, most things it's better that you do yourself. We might invoke the analog here of mitzvah bo yoser mi bishlucho. Most mitzvahs, generally speaking, it's more appropriate you do it yourself if you have a choice than appoint someone else to do it for you. So that was Rashi's position, and that would explain, by the way, why the Gemara would not accept Rabbeinu Tam's position, the chatchila. In other words, you shouldn't rely upon, well, I'll just bow in the middle of the bracha, maybe I'll be, you know, because you should really be saying, you should be doing it with the Shliach Tzibur. But now Tosa says, talking about our practice, stopping when the Shliach Tzibur is saying Kedusha and being silent, Rabbeinu Tamburi, Hayu Omrim, the Adarabba, the opposite of Rashi, Ishomea Ka'ona, Habe Hafsaka and Shosei. They say that you shouldn't stop for Kedusha, because if I am davening, and then I'm in the middle of a Refa'inu, or in the middle of Birchas Hashanah, and then the Shliach Tzibur gets the Kedusha, and I remain silent, and it's as if I'm answering, then it's as if I'm interrupting in the middle of Tzibur. However, Tosa says, Umikol makom, nagu ha'am lishtok v'lishmala. The minhag is like Rashi, v'godol ha'minhag. And the minhag is very powerful, and that's what we do. I believe it's Tamid Rabbeinu Yonah who explained that the reason why we do as Rashi is that even though Shomea Ka'one, it's like Ona, but it's not exactly like Ona. For example, when a Balkeri, as we learned in our Mishnah, a Balkeri cannot recite Shema for the Tanakhama, but he can be Maharher. He can sing Shema. And there are two opinions in the Gemara, but one opinion in the Gemara says that here, this was on the previous da, hirhur kedibur dami. That thinking is like speaking it. So then the Gemara says, yeah, but if thinking is like speaking it, then you haven't solved the problem. How can the Balkari sing Kriyashma if the Balkari can't read Kriyashma? And the answer is that the Gemara says it was like Sinai. At Sinai, you know, the issue was apparently speech. And therefore, even though hirhur is kedibur dami, thinking it is like you said it for the purposes of technically fulfilling your obligation, it's not a problem for the Valkyrie who shouldn't be reciting with Devarim Shebekdusha, words, you know, of holiness, because it's only if he actually articulates them. Even though you can fulfill your obligation without articulating them. So the same thing here. In order for something to be an interruption in the middle of your Amida, you have to say something. The fact that Shomea is Ka'ona, it's like your Ona, doesn't mean that it's actually as if you have articulated the words as if you were owned.
Rabbi, question for you. So sometimes the Shaliach keyboard's got some really cool melodies, you know, and you're in the middle of your Shemona Esrei and he gets the Kedusha. And these, you know, are you allowed to like hum along to these melodies, or you really have to just be absolutely quiet?
I think that it's appropriate to be silent, right? In other words, imagine Lahavdil Elef Alfa Havdalos. Supposing you're in the middle of your Amida, and then, you know, as one is often treated to in certain neighborhoods in New York City, you get music blaring from the neighborhood. You know, or I would say here in Columbus, Ohio, it happens to be the shul, is right behind it is the high school. And some of you may know that Friday night high school football in certain parts of America is a religion. So I think it was more cheering. But if you heard music there, and let's say you were really enjoying, I don't know, whatever the music was in the middle of your Amida, would we think it's appropriate for you to stop for a moment and start humming? I think the answer is no, right? That would be, even though technically you haven't said anything, I think that's considered a hefsek. So I would think, you know, I will confess that I might be mildly hypocritical here, although I don't say b'shamru on Friday night. I don't say b'shamru, and I don't say, v'yidabar shem esmodei Hashem, unless I'm davening for the omer. If I daven for the omer, then I say it. But my practice from a young age, from my rabbeim, the Mishnah Berurah talks about this. It's a hefsek, saying gula l'tfila. So I shul say it. I always tell students, it's absolutely categorically prohibited for you to not say it if you're the shleiach tzibur. You can't even try to fake it. You're obligated to say it when you daven for the omer. If you're so opposed to saying it, don't daven for the omer. But the question is, can I hum along with the tune? So I'll admit, when they do a shamru, I do it partially because I don't want people to be obvious that I'm not saying the shamru. But I do, but I'm not sure that's the same level of interrupting between, you know, Vishamru and interrupting your own private Amidah. So I would think that singing, even humming, would constitute a form of Dibur that would be inappropriate. That's what I would think. But I wouldn't be shocked if you find, you know, look, we do have this tradition, you know, when forgetting about what's the right time and whether it's really a problem in the first place, that after people wash, they don't talk, but they speak a different language. They speak the language of So, you know, I presume that that's actually a hefsek. That's no different than saying, can you please get in here? We're waiting and you're delaying us. And techaf, you know, l'netila bracha would be just as appropriate. But there does seem to be a minhag Yisrael to speak in this humming dialect, if you would like. So, I don't know.
I just want to interject and say hooray.
To which part?
To the part of rather than please pass the knife.
So I will say, that's for sure, Mutha, because that's like, that you can even say, you can ask for the knife. Once we're here, I think it's worth saying. You can ask for the knife after you've made the bracha b'motzi. Many people don't understand. What they'll do is they'll wash, they'll continue talking, they'll dry their hand, and then make the bracha after they finish talking. That's a bracha l'batala. You cannot, if you want, what the better thing to do is to, and the process of washing is putting the water on your hands and migul and drying them. Once you've dried your hands, the mitzvah's over. If you haven't made the bracha and you talk, you're now interrupting between the mitzvah and the bracha. It would be better to make, to wash your hands, dry them, make the bracha while you're doing that. And then if you have to say something, say it after you've made the bracha between the tivash yadayim and hamotzi. But make sure you hold your hands up in the air so you're watching them, so you have no hesed hadas about what your hands touch when you're busy talking. So if you really, the minhag is not to talk between the bracha of Netilas Shadayim and Hamotzi. But if you have to, if you're trying to get people to the table, if you need to know what wine you're going to, for those of us who make Kiddush after we wash. If you need to know what wine you're making on, you can ask the person. It's not really a hafsaka. Once you make the bracha of hamotzi, before you've eaten from the bread, you're only allowed to interrupt then if it's needed for what you're doing. So the Gemara talks about, the Gemara we will get to Mir Tashem later in Brachos, in the, I think it's in the sixth parak, if you need salt, you know, for their bread, you had to have salt. They didn't put salt in the bread, and it was inappropriate to have a bracha, if you had a choice, on bread that didn't have salt. Or, believe it or not, if you didn't feed the dog that morning, and you're not supposed to eat breakfast before you feed the dog, so you can say, after you made the bracha mochi, and you realize that you didn't give Fido his food, you can say, give Fido his food. Right? That's not considered a hefsek, because it's letzorech achila, letzorech that bracha. But if you're going to interrupt, you need to talk about something. For some reason, you just have to talk about the Dodgers not making the World Series. It's just too important, you know, that the hana you got, that they abandoned New York in your childhood, and this is Hashem's nekama. So you just can't control it. Better to say it between the Tila Shadarim, the bracha, and the bracha of Hamotz. But I believe, as Rabbi Luchstein suggested, that the language of is probably just as much of a hefsek as it is to say, you know, yay, the Dodgers lost. Yes, Lakamasha.
Rabbi, your premise for modim is that has to do with bowing. And my question is, what's so important about bowing? Certainly when we say hallel, which would be the ultimate of giving thanks, we're not bowing at all.
You're asking why do we bow at modim?
Yes.
That's a good question. I don't know I'm going to push you off, God willing, until we get to when the Gemara in the fifth parak. We're moving along. You know, it may take another year or so. I'll have to think about why is the significance of bowing at modim?
We won't do it at Hallel.
No, I understand the question. But let's just, for our sugya, I'm just going to accept the premise that we do bow at modim, and certainly you can understand why everybody bowing modim and you're not bowing is a problem. It's a good question. Why is it that I understand why we bow at the beginning. I would have thought maybe bow at the end of Shemona Esrei or something like that. But it's a good question. I don't know why. Rabbi Lipstein, do you know why we bow at modim?
No.
I'm feeling I'm going to be embarrassed that the Gemara is going to quote a pasuk or something like that. Which still, and that might not, we might not have the question still, why don't you bow during Hallel? But the answer to Hashem, I have to have an answer by the time we get to the Gemara about the bowing. Okay. Anyway, bottom line is that our practice is, like Rashi, that you remain silent, if you're in a situation where the Shliach Tzibur has reached Kedusha and they're saying Kedusha, you remain silent and you rely upon Shamaya Ka'one, despite the objections of Rabbeinu Tam and the Rebbe. Okay. Any questions on this? Because otherwise, if we finish this, it's really on to the next sugya. Okay. So now, we go back to the Gemara. And now the Gemara talks about Rabbi Yehuda's position. The Tanna Kamma had said that you do not make brachos. You do not make brachos Kriya Shema. You do not make the bracha before Kriya Shema or the bracha after Kriya Shema if a person is at the status of a Baal Keri. Okay. So Rabbi Yehuda says you do. And it seems like Rabbi Yehuda doesn't seem to be concerned about the person reciting these Dvarim Shebekdusha, even though the person is a Baal Keri. So the Gemara says, "Lameimar de Kasava Rabbi Yehuda Baal Keri Mutar B'Divrei Torah." Can we infer from this, the logical inference would be that Rabbi Yehuda basically doesn't...
Rabbi, where are you?
I'm sorry. We are in the middle of Pafal of Amid Beis at the two dots. It's about halfway through the narrowest of the lines. And it begins, Rabbi Yehuda Omer Mevarech Lefnei Molacharei. So the Gemara says, "Lameimra de Kasava Rabbi Yehuda Baal Keri Mutar B'Divrei Torah." It sounds like Rabbi Yehuda believes there's no problem. We would say there's no takonas Ezra. There's no institution of that. So the Gemara says, but how can that be? V'ha'amar Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, minayin leval keri she'asr b'divrei Torah. How do we know? And when you use the word minayin, it usually means what is the scriptural source, which you should realize immediately, even though Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi has this drasha, he has this scriptural interpretation, we do not believe that a Baal Keri is prohibited in Talmud Torah Midda Oraisa. It is presumed to be the takana of Ezra, that a Baal Keri is Asa B'Divrei Torah, he can't say Kriya Shema, he can't say Tefillah until he goes to the Mikvah. So Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi said, how do we know that a Balkari is also B'Devei Torah? Shene'emar, V'hodatam levanecha v'levnei vanecha. Moshe Rabbeinu, in his speech in Parshas of Asanan, is reminding us what we have to transmit to our children and our grandchildren. He says, V'hodatam levanecha v'levnei vanecha. V'samechle, right next to that, the next pasuk is, Yom asher amadta l'fnei Hashem Elokecha b'chorei. The day that you stood before God, before the Lord your God, in Mount Chorei, in Har Sinai. Malahalon, just as at Har Sinai, Bale Kerian Asurin, right, the people had to separate from their wives 3 days before, and they had to go to the mikveh before. So just as at Har Sinai, a Balkari could not be present for the initial, the first ever historical shir that God gave, so too, Afkan, so too, when we teach our children and grandchildren Torah, so too, Bale Kerian are Asurin. They also can't study Torah when the Balkari, they have to go to the mikveh first. So how could Rabbi Yehuda ignore this drasha of Rabbi Yehuda ben Levi? Now the Gemara says, "V'chi tema Rabbi Yehuda lo darish smuchim." You might say that Rabbi Yehuda doesn't accept this exegetical method of looking at two verses that are juxtaposed to one another. And here I wanna, I know that at KJ they don't say brachos and karbanos. But they do say Rabbi Yishmael, right? They start at Rabbi Yishmael. And I know that many people say Rabbi Yishmael, but when their eyes glaze over at listening all the different exegetical methods. Now, some of them we recognize. Many of us know, most of us know what a Kal V'Chomer is, right? Many of us know what a Gzeira Shava is. Some of us might know what a Binyan Av is, but maybe it's a little confusing, Mikasav Echad or Mishteksuv. Now, so most of the things, So I'm going to come back and talk about a few of those midos. I hope it will add a little bit of appreciation when you say certain things in Rabbi Yishmael. But for the moment, I'm going to make reference to two things that are actually not listed in Rabbi Yishmael's 13 exegetical methods. One of them, which the Gemara assumes is broadly accepted, and one of them is disputed. The one that's broadly accepted is that which is known as a hekesh, as a comparison. And a hekesh, generally speaking, I think, can come in one of two ways in the Torah. Way number one is when the Torah explicitly links something. So the Torah speaks about kachatos ka'asham Torah haslohem. The Torah explicitly justifies the chatas sacrifice and the asham sacrifice. And therefore, in many ways, one can sort of learn halachos from one to the other. Or you can also have what's called a hekesh, where within one verse, two different laws are presented, two different things are presented. And because it's in one sentence, there is an implied hekesh, an implied comparison between the two. That is method number one, and that I think is broadly accepted. Method number two is what the Gemara is talking about here, which is known as smuchim, two verses that are next to one another. A classic example, which the Gemara doesn't cite here, although it might be the subject of dispute, is that the Torah in Parshas Ki Tzeitzeh says, in the first pasuk it says, Lo silvash sha'atnez, semer ufishtim yachav. You're not allowed to wear sha'atnez, wool and linen in one garment. The very next verse says, Gidilim taselach, that you should make for yourself fringes, al arba kanfos kisusacha asher tachaseba, on the four corners of the garment that you use to cover yourself. So the first pasuk talks about the prohibition of shatnez, and the second pasuk talks about the mitzvah of tzitzit. And from this, some derive in the Gemara and Yevamos that if I am wearing an all-linen garment, and I want to put tzitzis on it, and if I were to put tcheles on my garment, and tcheles means blue-dyed wool, then I am going to end up putting woolen and making knots, tying woolen fringes, or part of it is wool, to my linen garment, and that would be shatnez. And what we learn from the adjacency, if I can use that term, the smuchim of these two verses, is that at least min haTorah one is permitted to do so. So if you wore an all-linen talis, never heard of one of those, I think the minhag is probably not to do that. If you wore an all-linen talis, you could put at least in HaTorah, you can put cheles on that talis, even though you are wearing shatnez while you are doing it. Because of this juxtaposition, the Gemara learns that because they're next to one another, the mitzvah aseh, the positive commandment of tzitzis, pushes aside the negative commandment, the prohibition of wearing shatnez. So that would be smuchim, two verses that are next to one another, and this is the point that the Gemara is exploring now. Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi's juxtaposition, his smuchim, was Hodatam levanecha v'levnei vanecha, teaching our children and grandchildren, and then Yom Asher Amad levnei Hashem Elokecha v'choreis. Comes very short, comes there right after, but it's a different pasuk. Can you juxtapose these two things and say that a Balkari is not allowed to study Torah, just as he couldn't be at Maim at Har Sinai listening to God teach Torah then? So the Gemara says, V'chi teima Rabbi Yehuda lo darish smuchim. If you want to argue, Rabbi Yehuda doesn't subscribe to this exegetical method. But for Amar Rabbi Yosef, afilu man de lo darish smuchim b'chol Torah, the Mishpat Torah darish. Now, I'm not going to go into why. When you read this Gemara, the Gemara first says the following. Even those who don't accept the principle of smuchim in the first four of the books of the Torah, in Mishnah Torah and Sefer Dvarim, they accept the principle of smuchim. Now, it's really, really, really interesting. The Gemara here doesn't ask or explore why. The Gemara in Yevamos does. And the Gemara in Yevamos gives a very strange answer. The Gemara in Yevamos explains in depth why in the cases in Mishnah Torah and Sefer Dvarim that Rabbi Yehuda, who's the one who's normally not Dorish Smuchim, he does use this method in Sefer Dvarim. The Gemara explains is because the cases he uses it, the Pesukim were extra. Something was extra. And because it's extra, he uses the method of Smuchim. It's very strange. I remember I taught Yevamos many years ago, and I pointed out what's very odd about it is then it means it's not really a difference between Sefer Dvarim and the rest of the Torah. It's just by chance. The case or cases that happen to appear in Sefer Dvarim, something is superfluous because it's superfluous. You can now darshan. You can now use, you know, unusual exegetical methods. But it sounds from the Gemara here and just the way it's presented, the initial statement, that it's a categorical difference for some reason between Sefer Dvarim and the rest of Torah. What would the reason be? The suggestion that I would make that the reason they why might be different, and I'm not sure I fully understand this, but is that the way the rest of the Torah was written and the way Sefer Dvarim were written were two very different ways. The Gemara in Megillah and Daf Lamed Aleph Amud Beis speaks of the difference between the curses, the Tochacha, in the book of Vayikra in Parshas Bechukosai, the curses there, and the curses in Parshas Kisavo at the end of Sefer Dvarim. And the way the Gemara describes it is that the curses in Sefer Vayikra are Moshe Mipi HaGevura, Moshe from the mouth of God. The curses in Sefer Dvarim, which is really in some ways true about all of Sefer Dvarim, is Moshe Mipi Atzmo, because Moshe Rabbeinu, even though God gave his full stamp of approval to put it in the Torah as Moshe Rabbeinu presented it, it was Moshe Rabbeinu's language. So I wonder whether or not the fact that it was Moshe Rabbeinu's presentation, which subsequently then got God's approval as opposed to God's presentation, perhaps the assumption is that when a human being is presenting these laws, he's sort of more drawn by his context, the way the human mind works, of association, and therefore in Mishnah Torah, Moshe Rabbeinu, put the two together, we would interpret smuchim. Whereas in the rest of the Torah, God's wisdom, his mind is not mind in any sense of it, and therefore we can't fathom necessarily why he would have put two things together unless we have a received tradition that, of course, you have to interpret these verses in a certain way. I don't know. Again, the Gemara Yevamos suggests that really there is no difference between Sefer Dvarim and the rest of the Torah in the cases that they deal with, but at least the statement that's presented sounds like it's really a fundamental difference between Mishnah Torah and the rest of the Torah. That afilu leman de'amar de'lo darish smuchim, even the opinion that you cannot use this method generally, the Mishnah Torah darish in Sefer Dvarim you do.
Don't the Parshanim, you know, I mean, so much of what we're reading about in the liner notes of a Chumash seem to be hinged on this story follows that story and we learn this lesson from that, et cetera, et cetera.
for sure homiletically, for sure personally in narrative, that's the case. I mean, I would say it's a modern sensibility, but it's really not, in the sense that Chazal and the Medrash are already sensitive to many of the literary aspects and to the juxtaposition of stories. But the law might be different. I mean, again, it is somewhat, you know, sometimes we would look at different parshios of law next to one another, and we would say they naturally belong together. Sometimes there are certain collections of laws in the Torah which we look at it, and it do seem to be kind of miscellaneous, right? Let's take a look at the next example in the Gemara. But you're correct, Lenny. There's no question when it comes to narrative, sequence is important, and Chazal already, and certainly the Rishonim and the Parshanim, certainly are not at all shy about talking about Lama Nisna HaParsha Zo LaParsha Zo. The question is only as a technical exegetical method in sections of law, is it actually relevant? And again, I think it's particularly in things that seem to have no relationship to one another. In other words, on the surface, Tzitzis and Shatnez, you would just think it looks, I mean, if you look in that section of Tzitzis, it does kind of feel like it's kind of random laws put together. That Moshe Rabbeinu like had to fill in stuff that he hadn't fully explained, or he hadn't even, weren't even mentioned in the first books of the Torah, and he kind of just puts them together. So you can understand the question, is there really rhyme or reason to the order or not? Or when that happens, when the Ribbono Shel Olam does it in the first books, whether there's sort of rhyme or reason or not, you can understand why someone asked the question. They seem to be totally unrelated. But when it comes to narrative, I think you're 100% correct. And there's no question about it.
Question.
Yes, my lord.
In the particular case that the Gemara is talking about, the two psukim are absolutely not just connected, but they're saying the same thing. I mean,
I know.
Be careful not to forget all the things that you saw, and they shouldn't be disappear from your heart. And tell it to your children and grandchildren.
I know. I was afraid someone's going to go back and read the psukim and ask that question. Right, it's all asmachta. That's I think the answer to the question. And because they're in separate psukim, and it's their asmachta, that's why the Gemara play with this. But I was afraid someone was going to ask the question. Of course, the Pshuta Samikra, the two verses are one verse. There are certain psukim in the Torah where you can look at them, and it's actually one sentence split into two verses. And this is a good example of that. There are not so many, but there are a number of them. So it's kind of really hard to, you know. Why is this verse split into two lefi pshuta shemikra? Because otherwise it would be a monstrously long verse. So yes, I think the answer has to be that because this is asmachta, the Gemara is willing to say, okay, since it's technically in two verses, the way our Masoretic tradition breaks it down, we're going to treat it as smuchim, even though it's literally one sentence. That's the best I can do. I'm sorry. But the question is better than my answer. So the Gemara now says, Uvachala Torah Kula Binalan de Lozarish. How do you know that Rabbi Yehuda doesn't employ the principle of smuchim in the rest of the Torah outside of Sefer Dvarim? So the Gemara says, Titania, we have a Braisa. And as I omer, Nemar mechashefa lo sechaya, the Nemar koshochevim behema moshimas. These two verses are in Parshas Mishpatim next to one another. What does the prohibition against sorcery and the prohibition against bestiality have to do with one another? And I presume the answer is nothing. I don't know why the Torah puts it together there, but the Torah does. The next pasuk, by the way, is Zoveach Elohim Yoharam. Someone who slaughters to another god, to a foreign god, gets put to death. What is the connection between these three? I think here we can truly say God only knows. But the bottom line is they don't appear to be connected in substance, but they are put next to one another. So Ben Azai says the following, Samchu inyan lo lomar, they're put next together to teach us, ma shochevim behima b'skila, at mechashefa nami b'skila. Now, just as one who commits an act of bestiality gets the death penalty of skila, so too someone who performs an act of tishuf, of sorcery. Now, how do we know that someone who commits an act of bestiality gets the death penalty? Rashi explores that. It's not explicit, but they learn that in Parshas Kedoshim, in the Arayos there. So we know that someone who commits the act of bestiality gets the death penalty of Shkila. So here, the two psukim, Mechashefa lo sechayeh, you shall surely not allow the Mechashefa to remain alive, and Koshochevim meimah moshimas, anybody who sleeps with the Hema, shall surely be put to death. The juxtaposition is to teach you that we know the death penalty by bestiality, and that same verse, same kind of the death penalty, same flavor of the death penalty is applied by someone who commits sorcery. That was Ben Azai's position. That's how he derived that you give a sorcerer the most severe form of the death penalty. There are four forms of the death penalty. We say them in the Al-Khayt, Sfila, Sreifa, Hereg, and Chenek, and that's the order of severity. The least severe is being beheaded by the sword. The most severe is being is Sfila, whatever Sfila entails. So the Gemara says, so that's what Ben Azai said. How do we know that you give a sorcerer, a mechashev, how do you know you give them the most severe form of the death penalty? The answer is because of the smuchen. Because it is samach too, kol shochev meima mashimas. Amar le Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yehuda comes and objects and says, v'chim et neish samchu inyan lo, notzi lezel eskila, just because of smuchen, you're going to give them a chashefa, the most severe form of the death penalty? That's not sufficient. That's not sufficient. Ella, so how do you know? How do you know that you give a source? Rabbi Yehuda doesn't disagree on the law. He disagrees only on the source for the law. How do you know? He says, Ella, ovi yedoni, bichlal kol hamachashefim hayu. And ovi and yedoni are two forms of sorcery of summoning the dead. One of them is called, one of them would be, I think, ovi is called necromancy. So ovi yedoni were bichlal kol hamachashefim hayu. They were included in all of the forms of kisha. If you look in Parsha Shoftim, the Torah says, lo yimatzei b'cha, mavir b'no b'tova esh, kosein kisamim, me'onein umnachesh umachasheh, v'chover chaver, v'shoel ov v'yidoni v'doresh el hamesim. In Parsha Shoftim, the Torah lists all of these forms of sorcery. They're all sorcery, they're all basically, pretty most of them, are forms of kisha. That's what the Yehuda says. So when the Torah, at the end of Parshas Kedoshim, in the last verse, says, V'ish o isha, ki yevohem ov o yidha oni mos yumasu, vo'even yirgimu osam demehem ba. The last Parsha, after all the arayos, all of a sudden the Torah throws in one pasuk at the end of Parshas Kedoshim and says that if a person performs the act of summoning the dead of ov o yidoni, they are responsible for their own blood and they will be stoned to death. So Rabbi Yehuda says, we already knew that a sorcerer gets the death penalty, mechashe falos chayeh. Why does the Torah come along and repeat over Yidoni? Why does it need to single them out amongst sorcerers, forms of sorcery that get the death penalty? So Rabbi Yehuda says, v'loma yatsu, why were they repeated? They were singled out, lahakish lahem v'lomar, l'cha ma'ovi Yidoni b'sfila, af mechashefa b'skila. Just as an ov and yidoni get skila as their death penalty, because the Torah says it explicitly, v'even yer gemu osam demehem bam, so too every other form of kishuf that gets the death penalty gets skila. What is this method of exegesis? This is kol davar shahaya b'chlau. This is something that was included in the broader principle. V'yotza min haklau. And it now was brought, it was sort of singled out. Lo lalamed al atzmo yatza, el lalamed al haklal kulo yatza. In what, it didn't just sort of step out of line to teach you about itself, but to teach you about the entire klal. In other words, the Torah says sorcerers get the death penalty, and ovi yidoni is a kind of sorcerer that was specifically warned about that form of kishon. The Torah then is motzi ovi yidoni to tell us that you get skila. We already knew you get the death penalty. And the purpose of that was to teach us that every form of sorcery gets skila. So now, when you read in Rabbi Yishmael, kol davar shei b'chlal yatzeh min haklal, lo lama yatzeh min yatzeh, el lama yatzeh kula yatzeh, now you understand what this principle is. And the truth is, in some ways, it's an intuitive principle. Right? If you have all these school children, and then one of them, you know, gets the homework assignment, presumably it applies to the other ones as well. Now, you might be wondering that there's another principle in the Yud Gam Umidas which says, kol davar shayatza min haklal, lidon v'davar hachadash, to teach us something new, iyata yachal lachziru l'chlalo, ad shi yachzirenu akasiv l'chlalo b'feirish. Once the Torah singled it out, it's now been singled out, it's out of line, it no longer has the laws that apply to the other things. So the question is, what is the difference between these two principles? Because they seem to, in effect, teach us the opposite thing. One of them is singled out to teach you about the larger principle. One of them is singled out and now basically has been pulled out of line and is totally different. So let me give you an example of that. It's a little complex, but too complex. But the Torah speaks about the blood of it speaks about the Asham. It says, Ki kachatos v'chola Asham hula kohen, kodesh karasham hu. I hope I didn't invent the pasuk there exactly. And maybe it's just Ki kachatos Asham hula kohen, kodesh karasham hu. So why does the Torah, what is the Torah teaching us by reminding us that a karban Hashem is like a karban chatas? What didn't we know? And this is by the way, by the Hashem that a metzora brings when he purifies himself. Why does the Torah have to tell us this? So Chazal explained that most animals, what you do with their blood is you put it on the Mizbeach. When you bring a sacrifice, you put the blood on the Mizbeach. The karban Hashem that a metzora brings is somewhat unique because you put from the blood of the animal on the metzora's right earlobe, on his right thumb, on his right big toe. Right? The Torah specifically describes the ceremony. So you might have thought that if you're putting the dam there, and the Torah doesn't explicitly state that you put the dam on the Mizbeach, something like that, you might have thought that you don't put the dam of the Asham on the Mizbeach. I hope I'm getting the exact details. By the Torah saying, Kachatas, Asham hu lakohen, the Torah is now restoring the Asham, bringing it back into the general rule that there's dam on the Mizbeach. That's how that particular rule works. But that's a situation where it's Yatza Lidon V'davar HaChadash. The Torah is teaching us something totally related, totally new, totally unrelated. However, our principle here is that the Torah goes out to provide an additional detail that we didn't know. But once it provides us the additional detail by this thing, it applies to all things in the same category. So we knew that the sorcerer received the death penalty. And then over Yidoni were Yatsam and Achal, but lo lalam el atzman yatsa, not to teach us only about themselves that the death penalty is skiva, el lalam el achal kulo yatsa, to teach us about the entire category of sorcerers who get the death penalty, they get the death penalty of skiva. So Rabbi Yehuda, the upshot of all of this Gemara is particularly difficult because there are so many other pieces of information in this Gemara, but the upshot of this particular brisa is that Rabbi Yehuda does not subscribe to the principle of smuchin, at least this happens to be Sefer Shmos. This happens to be in the book of Shmos, in Parashas Mishpatim, Kumachashe follows Chayeh, Koshochev, Beimamos Yumas, the juxtaposition of sorcery and bestiality. Rabbi Yehuda says, you cannot learn from the juxtaposition that the sorcerer gets stila. You have to learn it from somewhere else. So that's how we know that Rabbi Yehuda doesn't interpret smuchin outside of Sefer Dvarim. And then the Gemara says, Uva Mishneh Torah, Minolon, Didarish. How do you know that Rabbi Yehuda actually darshan smuchim in Sefer Dvar? So the Gemara is going to cite one example. Just before we read it, one piece of background, so make it go a little bit faster. Almost all of the prohibited sexual relations of incest of relatives that are a product of marriage persist even after the death of a relative. So for example, if a man's brother married a woman, and let's assume that the brother had children, even after his brother dies, he may not marry his brother's now former wife. In other words, it's not only if his brother is alive and divorces his wife, that she is considered eshes ach, and prohibited as one of the forbidden arayas, forbidden sexual relations. But even if the brother is dead, if a person may not marry his father's wife, even though his father has divorced her, and even though his father has died, assuming it's not his mother, assuming it's a stepmother, or for example, a man may not marry his son's wife, even if the son has died, his daughter-in-law, because almost all the arayos, with really one exception, the prohibition remains even after death. The exception is a wife's sister. If a man divorces his wife, his sister-in-law is an erva, but if his wife dies, he's permitted to marry his wife's sister. So the question is the following. What happens if a person's relative, instead of marrying a woman, simply had a sexual relationship outside of marriage, either consensual or non-consensual? What would be known as mifuta, which means literally seduced, but it means consensual, or anusa, it means rape. So supposing a man's father or a man's son or a man's brother, you know, had a sexual relationship with a woman, either anusa or mifuta, is one now allowed to marry that woman? So the generally accepted position, I'm not going to deal with psychology and anything else here, is that one is permitted. That the prohibition of the arayos technically only apply, and not only technically, halakhically speaking, only apply to a person that your relative married. The father performed an act of kiddushin with the woman, his brother performed an act of kiddushin with the woman, his son performed an act of kiddushin with the woman. That's the only, that's the only time it's prohibited. With one exception, according to Rabbi Yehuda, as we're about to see. So the Gemara says that, how do we know that Mishnah Torah, the third of the medium width lines in the Gemara Chafal upon the base, over Mishnah Torah Minov on the Darish, Titania, Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Nose Adam Anusas Aviv Umafutas Aviv, Anusas Beno Umafutas Beno. Rabbi Eliezer, and this is the accepted position, says that there is no prohibition in marrying a woman with whom his father, son, or any other Arab for that matter had a sexual relationship, as long as there was no marriage. However, Rabbi Yehuda disagrees. Rabbi Yehuda Oser Ba'anusas Aviv Umafutas Aviv. Rabbi Yehuda prohibits specifically in one case, that is one's father's paramour. Any woman that his father had a sexual relationship with, Rabbi Yehuda says is prohibited. How did Rabbi Yehuda learn this then? So the Gemara explains. V'chsev in Parshas Kisese, lo yikach ishes eshes aviv, v'lo yigaleh kenach aviv. The Torah, now I'll give you what the pshat is in this pasuk. The pshat in this pasuk is the Torah says that one may not reveal the kenach, one may not have a relationship with his father's wife, because by doing so, he will be megaleh the kanaf of his office. He will uncover his father's erva in some way. That's probably the pshat in the pasuk, which means it's only talking about eshes avit. However, Rabbi Yehuda darshins kanaf, well, the Gemara darshins, kanaf shera aviv lo yigala, a garment which his father saw, I mean he saw revealed, he shall not have a relationship, lo yigala. But how do you know that kanaf aviv refers to a woman who even wasn't married to his father? In other words, the pasuk says lo yikach ish es ishes aviv v'lo yigaleh kanaf aviv. How do you know v'lo yigaleh kanaf aviv refers to something else? So Rabbi Yehuda says b'samach lei v'na'i nasana isha shochev ima la'avi hanara chamishim kasef. The Torah says that if a man rapes a nara, he's got to pay all sorts of penalties, and then he's got to marry her. She wants it, and her father wants it. And the very next pasuk after the parsha of rape is lo yikach ishes ishes aviv v'lo yigaleh kanaf aviv. So from the fact that they are juxtaposed, Rabbi Yehuda says lo yigaleh kanaf aviv refers to a situation of anusa, and it doesn't have to be only anusa. It doesn't have to only be rape. It means non-marital situations of a sexual relationship with this person's father and a woman render her prohibited to him. That's Rabbi Yehuda's position. And therefore you see that he does utilize the method, the exegetical method of smuchin in Sefer Dvarim. So the question now is, why does Rabbi Yehuda not accept Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi's smuchin, the connection between Yom Asher Amata L'fnei Hashem Elokecha B'chareiv, the rules at Har Sinai where Balkari could not be present to learn Torah, and V'hodatam Levanecha Olevei Vanecha, the post-Sinai obligation of teaching our children and our grandchildren Torah? Why does Rabbi Yehuda not accept that suchim, and thereby, why would he permit, if he doesn't, and if he did, he wouldn't permit reciting the brachos of Kriyashma before and after, because presumably he would also say you shouldn't even recite Kriyashma, at least the Dibur. So that's the Gemara's question. I'm not going to go further now, but God willing, next week, we will explore what the Gemara's answer is. How is it that Rabbi Yehuda either doesn't accept Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi Smuchin, or if he does, why is it that he permits a Balkari to recite Birchos Kriya Shema? Okay. Are there any questions? Okay.